Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast. I'm your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. This podcast brought to you by our friends over at WinBet. We got an awesome show lined up for you today. We're going to get into the RotoWire staff dynasty. So give you guys a little peek behind the curtain of how the RotoWire brain trust is attacking this rookie draft and the dynasty draft as a whole. And we're also going to give you a sneak preview into Mario's upcoming article breaking down the Falcons offense. I mean, there's so many moving parts there. The new addition of Arthur Smith coming over from Tennessee, a lot of stylistic differences between the way those two offenses ran a year ago. So figuring out how it's going to look on the field in 2021, one of the more interesting storylines, especially for fantasy, especially when you got guys like Julio Jones, Calvin Ridley, and of course, Kyle Pitts, and also no real running game to speak of, at least that we know of. So no Derrick Henrys at all, not even a Deion Lewis. So we'll see how things shake out in Atlanta. But Mario, leading things off, what are your initial impressions here of how the first round of the RotoWire Dynasty draft has unfolded? Of course, start leading things off with Chris Benzine taking Ja'Marr Chase at 1-1.
Yeah, that was a good pick by Chris. I think there's pretty much like four players, maybe three, that in one quarterback leagues, PPR scoring are justifiable first overall picks. And I guess most people would say the favorite, the consensus first overall pick is actually someone that I don't include in that top four, and that's Najee Harris. But that's a different conversation, I guess. But Chase for Chris was a good pick. I think Chase, Etienne, Pitts, and indeed Trevor Lawrence. I know it's a one quarterback league, but since we're 14 team instead of 12 in this league, I actually think it's almost like halfway between a 12 team, one quarterback and a 12 team super flex or two quarterback, because it's one thing to kind of stream quarterbacks when you have a supply of alternatives, but when you're in a 14 team league and people aspire to have backups because the security of the waiver wire basically doesn't exist. It's like, if Taylor Heinicke is a free agent in this league, I'll be surprised. If Teddy Bridgewater is a free agent in this league, I'll be surprised. So when you get into the regular season, if you have a bye week, you either have a decent backup or you kind of just are looking pretty rough for that particular week. And if you get an injury, your season's over. So that's a certain strategy someone in this league could take, like just saying, I'm not going to have a backup, or I'm not really going to care about my quarterback depth. I'll just see if my one guy does it. But if that one guy does not do it, you have no recourse at all. So I think actually having a Trevor Lawrence type of quarterback is a nice thing for a team in this sort of format, because you get a lot of security and upside, whereas other teams are kind of trying to patch together a sort of version of upside and security. And in one particular pick, you can get it with Lawrence, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I'm one of the guys that just kind of went for two value quarterbacks, and I'm carrying both of them on my roster for this upcoming season, but I don't feel great about either of them. I have Ryan Tannehill and I have Daniel Jones, so I'm feeling pretty shaky, and I actually have been eyeing some Taylor Heineke in the later rounds, just in case, break glass in case of emergency type of selection there, just to have a little bit of quarterback depth.
I mean,
all things considered, like you said.
If you get one of those lottery ticket guys as a third, especially, I think you'll be fine because, yeah, you got a strong roster aside from that at running back and receiver and tight end. So that your case, I think you're playing it pretty smart. But good first overall pick aside, our friend Chris Benzine's going to go into the year with just Stafford and see how it goes. And it's like, you know, could work. I had some leagues last year where I had both Jimmy Garoppolo and Ryan. Actually, I had my best ball team last year in that whatever that expensive NFFC version of it is. I had Dak, Tannehill, who had some kind of thing come up. I can't remember what. Maybe he was just a little inconsistent at some point. And Garoppolo. So I went into the year where I was supposed to be like totally secure at quarterback, and by week six, season over, pretty much. So that just shows it's like you can. There's of course a lot of ways things can play out, but that includes a lot of negatives. And in this league, you don't really have recourse if the negative happens.
No, absolutely not. Looking elsewhere. So like you said, the top four or so picks tend to be, at least in other dynasty leagues, tend to be fairly consistent. But there was a little bit of a surprise with the number three overall pick in this dynasty, where Devontae Smith went number three. And I think that definitely, you know, over a guy like Jalen Waddle, because the second pick was Kyle Pitts. So he goes before Trevor Lawrence, goes before Najee Harris or Travis Etienne. What is your impression of that pick taking Devontae at three? I mean, it could be viewed, if you're in a win now position, he does have a really good path to targets in that Philadelphia offense. I do question, you know, how pass happy they're going to be. I imagine that they're going to be kind of towards the bottom of the league in terms of passing volume. But again, there isn't like an obvious target hog that they have in that offense, other than maybe Dallas Goedert, at least right now. So Devontae Smith could be, but again, this is a team that was picking third in this draft, so they're not necessarily in that win now bucket.
Yeah, I wouldn't have made that pick. I wouldn't quite criticize it. Like I would definitely wouldn't have advised it, but since it was made, I'm not going to say like, oh my God, what were you thinking? But it wasn't something I would have considered. And I like Devontae Smith as a player, and I agree with the Eagles. He could be their leading target guy. And in fact, I would kind of make him the slight favorite, I think, to be their lead target guy right away. I think, though, that the Eagles probably have a little bit of like a Ravens with Lamar thing going on, where they're not even really going to aspire to throw the ball that much. And unlike Lamar, there's not really much reason to think Hurts will be better than a below average passer in the NFL. So there's a chance that there could be some like a high touchdown percentage in Hurts's attempts if his running ability works and if the offensive line improves from last year and Miles Sanders kind of bounces back a little bit. But if those things don't happen and there's a lot of pressure on Hurts to kind of move the chains, I worry about that getting bad pretty quickly, actually. And that's something that could actually precipitate a good change for Smith's narrow interest, because they could put Flacco on the field and then all of a sudden they're throwing a lot more, they're running a lot less, and it's probably not good offense, but more targets is more targets. And I would, even though I think lowly of Flacco, I would have to say he's probably a better pure passer than Hurts. If with Hurts, the whole theory of how it might work is that you leverage his rushing ability so that his difficulty level as a passer goes down. And I think you might squeak by if you do that and you commit to it and you do it well, but it's
going to be easy to screw up, I think, especially since that offensive line struggled so much last year. And you've got a couple raw receivers and not raw, but like Jalen Reagor's more toolsy than polished. And then Smith, he has a lot of polish, but not necessarily a whole lot in the way of tools. So those are two guys who are going to be better in a year or two than they are now. And now is when the quarterback needs more help than ever. So I'm a little anxious about how that offense might work. I see certain upside scenarios, but the way people talk about it as a given that Jalen Hurts lasts so much as like six games, I think is a little bit presumptuous.
The mention of Joe Flacco there, especially in the context of having a running quarterback also on the roster, just brings back warm memories of Lamar Jackson's rookie year in Baltimore, where they would occasionally put Joe Flacco out wide. And I've never seen a man look more disinterested on a football field than Joe Flacco in those packages.
Have you ever seen a man more interested in getting his receiver hung out to dry than when Flacco threw that dead ball Lamar on the
side? Oh, yeah.
Whatever. That was pretty funny. Yeah. Like, hey, Joe, surely you weren't just trying to get Lamar put on a stretcher there, right?
Like, yeah. Just like some Shakespearean, like single-handedly make sure that he secures the throne, but it with his own doing. Again, don't expect that from Philly, but we'll see what happens with that Philadelphia offense. And speaking of Jalen Hurts specifically, you made maybe the biggest splash move of the first round, trading. What was the exact
13 for 8. Okay. So Harry, our sharp tech guy, he's I think this is one of those trades that it made sense for both sides. Like I wasn't trying to move Hurts because I thought he was a stinker. It was just kind of, I wanted security with my quarterback backup. Like I already have Kyler Murray. So I wanted a quarterback to, if there was upside with Hurts, I wanted to move him because he's going to be on my bench. And aside from that, I didn't think he actually gave me the security function that I wanted in a backup, because I don't take it for a given that Hurts will be starting after week 8, and especially after this year. Like, even if Hurts starts 17 games, I really am not taking it as a given that he's starting for the Eagles in 2022. So the way I looked at it, I was like, I'm here at the 13th pick. I might be able to get someone like Bateman, a totally good receiver, somebody like that. But I thought, if I can churn this 13th pick into quarterback certainty for the next 2 or 3 years, then I guess I might as well see if I can do that. And I was a little worried that it would be a reach for Lance at 8, but I traded up Hurts and 13 for the 8th pick and took Trey Lance there. If in hindsight I could have made, or if I could do it over, if I regret this move in whatever 6 months, it'll probably be because I took Trey Lance instead of Elijah Moore, who was on the board. And I thought about it, but I was like, my receivers are actually pretty well built as it was. Like I went with a pretty wide receiver heavy strategy in the inaugural draft last year. So I didn't think I really needed the help at receiver. Whereas Kyler Murray breaking under Cliff Kingsbury, I am very much worried about, because Cliff Kingsbury is a terrible coach. He has no idea what he's doing. And it's left to Kyler Murray's shoulders and legs and knees to basically pick up all the slack from that man's incompetence. So there's only so many times you can gamble like that before things go wrong. And it started going wrong last year. I don't like throwing shoulder troubles for my quarterbacks. That's not what I want to hear about. And the problem is Cliff Kingsbury will never improve. He doesn't have the insight. It's not in him. He can memorize certain answers to certain quizzes, but if he has to kind of critically think his way out of a problem that he hasn't seen before, he's going to sink every single time. Or if he gets out, it'll just be by dumb luck and chance or things like that. So Kyler Murray is going to keep having to bail out Cliff Kingsbury by doing heroic running after the 5 wide curl routes across the board don't work the 45th time in a row that day. And eventually he's going to get rocked, and if he does, I want to have somebody like Lance who has that rushing upside. And I think the Shanahan system will kind of smooth out whatever limitations Lance might have, whatever underdeveloped areas of his passing skill set there might be. So I thought the security for the long term and the same functional utility as a backup, more or less, made it worth giving up Hurts, because as it was, I had no real security for my backup. It was him, and Jared Goff. And Goff, I'm, you know, concerned about for different reasons, but I like having Lance, and I might look into trying to move Murray if he has a decent year. Lance has a decent year, because in 14 teams, it's the other thing you got to keep in mind is that if you're at 14 for quarterback production, like it hurts more than being 12th in quarterback production for a 12 team league. So the divide can be more pronounced, and a top five kind of quarterback, I think, actually is pretty helpful in a league like this, especially if you believe what I do about my own team, which is like, I think I can find the good dart throws at receiver and running back that aren't, there's no such thing as the sleeper quarterbacks. You know, it's like, you just got to go get them. You're not going to, you're not going to have anybody sneak up, generally speaking.
No, like there's a reason why like none of the quarterbacks selected so far outside of the ones that went in the first round this year. Like I don't think any like of the Kellen Mond, Davis Mills types have been taken yet. So yeah, the sleeper, the idea of the sleeper quarterback, you know, the Tom Brady's or even like the Kirk Cousins's of the world are becoming, you know, even more and more scarce. Like the starting quarterbacks in the NFL going to be first rounders, like, you know, 99% of the time, it feels like it. And, you know, in defense of Cliff Kingsbury running the five wide curls, that was like our goal line play on my flag football team growing up. And it was pretty automatic.
Yeah. Cliff bringing out the best lessons of recreational flag leagues and bringing some innovation that the NFL badly needed.
See, exactly. Everyone's looking at the same things. He looks somewhere else and finds it. So, again, I thought that was an interesting move on your part and interesting stuff there, especially on like the long view on Kyler.
Yeah, I was worried about that being a reach for Lance, but as it turned out, Zach Wilson and Justin Fields were the next two picks. So I might not have been able to get that if I hadn't made that trade, I guess.
So maybe that you can talk me out of being bummed about this, but with Justin Fields going two picks later, he was top of my queue as far as what I wanted to do next. I wanted to grab Fields at 12 if I could have, or at 11, I'm sorry. Was not able to. Our guy Joe Bartle snagged him with the 10th pick in the first round. So I got your favorite running back, Javonte Williams.
Well, that was a good spot to get him, though. I actually do think, believe it or not, that Javonte Williams is good. It's just my whole position is like him and Zach Moss and Kylan Hill are basically the same sum of traits. Like if you're adjusting for size, if you're adjusting for production, whatever it is, like they're basically the same sort of application on the field. They're sub 220 guys, but plus 210. They run pretty tough. They aren't fast, but they kind of do have some elusiveness to them just for kind of how shifty and their anchor ability, their ability to convert anchor into explosiveness and vice versa. They're all very similar types. It's when people try to say that Javonte Williams is the best running back in the draft, or that he's even if they think he's better than Etienne or Najee Harris, I think that's nonsense too. So I'm a little bit lower on Harris than most people. So I think for Javonte Williams to be compared to Etienne is absurd, and even me, a Harris skeptic, thinks that it's pretty close to the same thing to think that he's better than Harris. Like I have concerns with Harris, but they all apply to Javonte even more so, and I have no idea how someone with a coherent process can conclude otherwise. It just doesn't make sense to me.
No, so yeah, getting the third. Got. Sure. Yeah.
11th is a lot better than first or second or third or something.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, this is a running back group that has some, at least for my team, I have Nick Chubb and Antonio Gibson. So, like, I'm not super worried about it, but the depth behind. Too, right? I do have Mostert. I do have Damian Williams. So, I mean, Mostert is a guy that I love watching him play, but it feels like the sports car that it's just so hard to keep on the road. The maintenance is so high, you know, always seemingly, you know, battling those bumps and bruises. So I've definitely wanted to bolster the running back spot if quarterback wasn't really on the table for me. I wasn't going to go ahead and like jump up Mac Jones to do it. And then, you know, I already had TJ Hockenson as my tight end. So I figured I'd grab a depth tight end afterward. And my receivers are pretty crazy loaded. I mean, AJ Brown, Chase Claypool, T. Higgins, DK Metcalf. So, I mean, it's, you know, I didn't really feel pressed to go receiver there. So adding running back seemed to make the most sense to me at 111. Let's move on over to the second round, or end of the first round, actually. So the pick that you ended up trading out of, number 13, ended up being Trey Sermon. What are your thoughts on him, you know, kind of dovetailing off of the Mostert mentioned there a minute ago?
So you might have picked up that sometimes I feel pretty sure about what certain players are and are not. Sermon is not one of those players. I'm not really confident about him either way. He's a confusing sort of evaluation for me because mm-hmm. in some of the ways that I evaluate running backs, he grades very well. Like, namely, he was a very explosive, consistently very explosive running back at both Oklahoma and Ohio State. So he has no actual history of failure, and he has a pretty much extensive history of being very explosive with the football. So that's something I definitely care about and something I find promising. Where I get a little anxious is when I try to figure out why he wasn't a starter and a workhorse at either school. Like, he kind of started later in that Ohio State season after, I guess, that huge Northwestern game, but he began the year, and I maybe even most of the year, was behind Master Teague on the depth chart. And Master
Teague, who was coming off an Achilles.
Yeah, Master Teague doesn't seem like much more than a Niall Davis type. Like, he's a huge, strong, fast guy, but he just doesn't really seem to have much like wiggle or running back instinct aside from that. So Master Teague might be good. I don't really have a strong take on him, especially not at this point. But it does bug me a little bit that Sermon didn't displace him from the depth chart early on. That said, it could just be that both Teague and Sermon are good, and it just wasn't really Sermon's fault.
It could be Ohio State politics too, you know, like, you know, Sermon was a transfer.
Yeah, it could be all those things. So with Sermon, I feel like there's so much that I can't know for sure that I can know with certain other prospects. So it makes me anxious to try to take any particular stand, but specifically the case study that concerns me with Trey Sermon is Josh Adams, because Josh Adams, I think, has quite a bit in common with Trey Sermon, namely that they were both very explosive college players. Like, Josh Adams was super productive at Notre Dame, and like even more so, he was a workhorse too. He wasn't just explosive, like an off the bench 10 carries per game kind of guy. Like, he was putting up big explosive numbers as a player taking on the team leading volume. And he's a little bit taller than Sermon, if I remember. At least probably like a half an inch or 3/4 of an inch taller than Sermon, and maybe the same weight or a little lighter than Sermon. So both of these guys, in either case, are kind of upright built for a running back. They're kind of tall for a running back, and then they don't have a ton of mass, and then they also kind of just have a sort of upright stance. Like, you can be 6'1", 215 like Sermon, and you can get a little lower than Sermon does. You can kind of break down in traffic a little bit better. But when I watch the tape of him, I feel like he has a pretty high center of gravity. And that concerns me, because when I look at someone like Josh Adams and I try to figure out why he didn't succeed in the NFL, you look across the board and it's not easy to find the obvious flaw. Like, it's just, this is a guy who is, aside from being kind of tall for a running back, he was fast. He was quick. Like, he had a really good 3-cone time. He was super productive. He didn't fail on the field in any meaningful sense. So what would it make a player bad in the NFL if he's a really productive, really explosive college runner who is fast and quick? And I think some of it might just be that his build is not as functionally ideal for the NFL, for football tasks generally, as it is for kind of just running in space. You know, it's getting to the open field and running is one thing, but it's not necessarily like a practical option if you're so bad in traffic that you kind of just get swallowed up before you can get into the open field. So I worry a little bit about that happening to Sermon as he increases his workload. Like, he should at the very least be an explosive off the bench guy. Like, it's perfectly consistent with everything he's ever done to be that much at least. The question to me is, like, if you get him to 12, 15 carries a game, does he start to kind of take some awkward hits because guys are sort of headhunting at him because he's got such a tall,
he runs narrow, high.
Yeah, so it's tough for me to know why a guy like Adams failed. And until I have an idea, I kind of get anxious about anyone that I think looks similar. And I think Sermon very much does. But maybe there's a, I don't know, his production's good. It's not like I want to fade the guy. And then, you know, quite pertinently for San Francisco, I don't need to believe the running back is that good to think.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
He'll be productive in the 49er system. And so,
right.
Jeff Wilson's a great example of that. He was a really good college player at North Texas, but he has no athleticism to speak of. And yet he was very productive last year. So do I think Sermon's better than Wilson? Definitely.
Right. Right. So that's a good way to contextualize it. And, you know, it maybe tips the scales as far as, you know, what could go right when it comes to Sermon. And again, it's a system that just seems to be automatic with its running back production. So we'll see how it works out for Sermon, but I think you do. You raise some fair concerns at the very least. Next up, we had a trio of receivers go off the board, and I just kind of want to hear your thoughts on the order in which they went, and you know, with whether or not that you know, these guys would have been someone that you were targeting if you were picking in this range. So end of the first round, and then the first two picks of the second, we had Terrace Marshall, now of the Carolina Panthers, Rondale Moore, now of the Arizona Cardinals, and Rashad Bateman, now of the Baltimore Ravens, go in order right there. So Marshall, Rondale Moore, and Rashad Bateman all in a row. What were your thoughts on that sequence?
So I probably would have picked them Marshall, Bateman, then Moore. It's not something that I feel strongly about, I guess, but Terrace Marshall, the first of those three, I do actually stand by pretty resolutely, because he's good. I don't think there's really any doubt that Terrace Marshall's good, and I know he might not be dominant. I know he's not a brute. He's not like a physical presence for how tall he is and how many kind of jump balls he came down with, how many red zone targets he came down with at LSU. But I think it's totally possible to be a finesse style player and do those things. And I think the fact that he did it at a young age, at a high level of competition, before testing well as an athlete, like all that stuff just kind of makes it add up to me. And I think it would be shocking if Terrace Marshall were bad in the NFL. So when I look at that team fit, it's like Curtis Samuel left, and that slot position is going to require, or at least last year, it entailed quite a few carries for Curtis Samuel. And Terrace Marshall can't take carries, or at least he probably can't. You probably don't want him taking carries.
That should be DJ Moore, I think. I would think if they keep that.
And I am actually kind of, I've been thinking a little bit the past few days, like I might be getting really high on DJ Moore, because if they move him into the slot, I think he can go nuts. And not because of the carries specifically. I think he's just a better fit there. I think he's a yards after the catch, speed, quickness guy. And I don't think he's a great downfield route runner. So I love DJ Moore in the slot. And if they do put DJ Moore in the slot, I don't think David Moore is going to beat Terrace Marshall outside for reps, not after a month or so. And I think David Moore might be pretty good, actually. And indeed, if they keep DJ Moore outside, David Moore might be the guy who gets those Curtis Samuel carries. He got some carries with the Seahawks the past couple of years, so we'll see. David Moore is not bad, I think, but I just think Marshall's really good. And if Joe Brady is thinking clearly, I think it's a pretty obvious outcome that they should pursue here, which is Robbie Anderson generally outside, DJ Moore generally in the slot, and Terrace Marshall generally outside. And
so question about like the Samuel carries that have been vacated. How much of that do you think was a function of just Curtis Samuel's background as someone who, you know, was kind of like a hybrid running back receiver at Ohio State, had proven at the NFL level that he can be an effective ball carrier out of the backfield? And then you add in the fact that Carolina was missing Christian McCaffrey, to where like maybe that role with the carries won't be quite as prominent this year from the slot, or am I off there?
I think it was
basically built to be that way. Samuel's skill set definitely factored into how they chose to build it, but I do think it was a deliberate outcome for them. So they might not be beholden to that at all. But if they do want to keep that there, I think DJ Moore can definitely do it and David Moore can do it a little bit. So we'll see. I think though that, you know, last year they wanted DJ Moore outside, specifically running the furthest downfield. Like even Robbie Anderson, they gave more slot work to, more underneath stuff to than DJ Moore, which I know they think they had a reason. I disagree with it, whatever it is. I still would have had Samuel playing outside last year, even with his carry ability from the slot, because Curtis Samuel's a great downfield route runner and he's faster than those other two, fast as those other two are. So I want Curtis Samuel running downfield, losing corners on posts and like deep comebacks, double moves downfield, things like that. You can give him the underneath carries too, but his route running is more unique than his yards after the catch ability. Like DJ Moore is better with the ball than Curtis Samuel is. So we'll see. If they stand by this year what they believed last year, they might not give DJ Moore too many slot reps, and it might be like David Moore getting a lot of the slot reps and then Terrace Marshall competing outside with Moore and Anderson, which of course he's going to lose in 2021. I could imagine Terrace Marshall replacing Robbie Anderson outside in a year or two, but this year he has to see DJ Moore move into the slot more than he did last year. But if that happens, I don't think David Moore can beat Terrace Marshall outside. And if Terrace Marshall's getting the reps outside, I don't really see any reason for caution. Like I think he's pretty clearly going to be a good player with his usage. And the only question for me is what kind of usage he gets and when. So I also think Darnold's a big upgrade over Bridgewater. So I think, you know, I'm a truther, I guess, for Darnold, but I don't think you need to believe he's very good to see that, you know, he's probably going to be better than Bridgewater. And if he is better than Bridgewater, that could open up things for everybody in that offense.
Yes. So yeah, we're in on that for sure. When it comes to the Carolina offense looking better, as long as Darnold kind of holds up his end of the bargain, which we think he will. So then that begs the question of Bateman versus Rondale Moore, because, you know, you look at the Ravens, number one in rush percentage last year, running play percentage by a long shot. You know, 55% of their plays were run plays. So that limits the overall target volume in this offense. You have guys like Mark Andrews and Marquise Brown already established as, you know, guys that are going to push for triple digit targets. So that starts to, you know, we're running out of slices of the pie at that point. They also brought in Sammy Watkins. So do we think that, you know, Bateman is someone who more so takes over a big role in his second year and maybe is kind of a little bit frustrating that this first year? I mean, I've been trying to figure this one out. You know, I follow the Ravens closely, so I'm just not sure, you know, with all the pieces that they have at receiver now, especially when you look past Marquise Brown and Mark Andrews on the tight end, but you know, you have Watkins, now you have invested draft capital in Bateman, Devin Duvernay, and Tylan Wallace. So, you know, how does it all shake out and for Bateman specifically?
So I would have taken Bateman over Rondale Moore, because I think while Bateman has legitimate concerns about his target volume and even his snap volume, I think those concerns apply to Moore just as much. And I think that while Moore is promising, and I do like Moore, I think Bateman is just totally clean as a prospect. And it wouldn't be unprecedented for a guy like Bateman to fail, but pretty close. And I think that Lamar Jackson, for whatever limitations he might have, or the scheme might have, whatever the play calling might have, he's going to always throw more touchdowns per attempt than most other quarterbacks. Slightly because he doesn't throw as many passes, and it's, you know, therefore some of those passes that he does throw are going to be more selectively, you know, opportunistic than the attempts a pure passer might get left with. But he scores touchdowns and he's unstoppable in the red zone because you can't actually defend him there. And if Bateman's on the field when they're there, then I think he profiles great for touchdown opportunities. So I think he will always be baseline or better for his efficiency and a usage basis. So I think Bateman being the better player and not having an obviously worse playing time usage situation should go ahead of Moore.
I do think, though, that the people who are getting their hopes up for 2021 Rashad Bateman might be a little disappointed. I think they're underestimating basically everybody else in that offense, but
right,
including Marquise Brown, but not just him, especially. Yeah, it's like I don't even know who people are overlooking worst. It's like Marquise Brown has this reputation of just being like a trash receiver, and that's ridiculous. People
are yeah,
just, that's goldfish brain.
They were mad because they drafted him what ended up being too high last year, but his last seven games of the year were great. And I think he had like five touchdowns in the last six or seven games of the season and had, you know, was consistently performing. You know, it obviously didn't end up being that year two breakout that either of us were expecting, but it, you know, it, if that presents an ADP buying opportunity when it comes to getting shares of Marquise Brown, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, so Bateman is not knocking Brown out of the lineup. It's just
no.
People should not consider that a possibility. Mark Andrews probably can't be negotiated down much either. Maybe you take away some of his tight end snaps. I don't know, but you're not really taking out Andrews' routes. You're just not. So Bateman has to displace not those two specifically, but rather in a row he has to displace Sammy Watkins and Devin DuVernay, which DuVernay is probably going to play a different position. I wouldn't be surprised if they try to mostly work him where Willie Snead was in the slot, generally speaking. And
yeah,
that actually could work pretty well because the past 2 years they've been doing these stupid like fake jet sweeps to Snead, and I don't believe they gave him a single carry the past 2 years. But if you watch them, they try to do this thing like eight times a game where they're like, oh, we might give it to Snead here, and then they never do, which nope. is a good idea because you shouldn't give him the ball. But Devin DuVernay with that carry is a very different question, and it might actually open an entirely new element of that offense. So DuVernay in the slot, which I think makes a lot of sense. Marquise Brown's going to get a lot of slot reps too, just mostly like the downfield pass attempts ones. And which is to say on the outside, you're and of course Andrews is going to get some of those slot receiver reps too. So outside, Bateman just has to beat, you know, Brown and Watkins. And I just don't think, like he needs to beat Watkins decisively to be useful in fantasy in an offense that throws this much and already has Marquise Brown and Mark Andrews in it. So I think even if Rashad Bateman has top shelf efficiency this year, it's going to be pretty tough for him to break something like 650 yards, in my opinion, because it's just, they're not really trying to do much more than that. They could have a really good year with him doing that or less than that. And if things are working, they're definitely not going to have an impetus to, you know, scrap the whole format. So me believing in Lamar the way I do and the way that I evaluate Marquise Brown, Mark Andrews, and Sammy Watkins, like I think Sammy Watkins is actually good. He's just been playing in some offenses that don't really suit him. And in Kansas City, he was doing a lot of dirty work to kind of free up other things. And then when they give him those outside downfield routes in the playoffs against Richard Sherman, he dusts him right off the bat. So I think Watkins playing in that offense actually could be pretty dangerous. I like him a bit as a sleeper, but he, of course, has durability problems. Marquise Brown, even though he hasn't had like durability problems in the NFL specifically, anyone that's skinny, you're asking for a durability problem if you put up his usage too much. So there's ways that it can break for Bateman that way. I just think it has to break for him that way. I don't think it's fair to expect him to be better than Sammy Watkins or Marquise Brown in his rookie year.
Right, exactly. So that pick probably ends up being more of a pick for the future. But you know, this was the team picking you know, second in the second round and second in the first round too, of course. So getting some guys that are going to be producing a little bit more down the road. Looking elsewhere, let's see, rounding things out. I didn't take a rookie with my second pick. The pool had kind of dried up. I was actually another Joe Bartle making me mad type of pick. He grabbed Nico Collins at 210, which spurned me to go ahead and go with Gronk, which, you know, I don't feel great about, but I needed a second tight end, and I sure wasn't going to get one of the rookies. So
yeah, that's
I just went with Gronk.
Yeah, even Freiermuth, I don't think is going to be in a position to produce this year. Him and Long are probably a year away, interesting as they both are. But yeah, I ended up going with Chuba Hubbard in the second round, not because I'm that high on him at this point, but I'm kind of just doing a zero running back approach in this league. That was my strategy the whole time because we have an extra flex spot maybe two, I can't remember. So basically, when you open up the extra flex spots and it's PPR scoring, the efficient way is to go receiver with those spots, because the scarcity prices at running back dictate that you're paying as much for, like, I don't know, Kareem Hunt as you are for, like, Kenny Golladay or something like that. You know, that's probably a conservative example. Like, you got just, like, crap running backs going ahead of guys that we would normally consider, like, wide receiver three types in 12-team leagues. So yeah. Putting those guys in the starting lineup and letting people keep their handcuff running backs in the lineup instead, like, that's just an easy choice for me. So I went with – I had Clyde Edwards-Helaire and James Robinson last year. Aside from that, I only have Tony Pollard, you know, to kind of wager on a Zeke injury, basically, and then Chuba Hubbard, basically, in case he is Mike Davis this year, which I definitely think he's better than Mike Davis. I don't know what to think about Hubbard at this point. I think he's mostly like a Ryan Grant kind of player. I was hoping he'd be a Lamar Miller, but I think he's a Ryan Grant. But I think Ryan Grant was a lot better than Mike Davis, too. So if the opportunity is there, I think it should work. And only need two running backs, so I'm kind of comfortable just taking those sort of, you know, injury swings at running back, since I only really need one to land. Hubbard, no, the second was the choice there. And then third, I went with Anthony Schwartz, even though I know he's probably at least 1 year, maybe 2 years away.
I was definitely thinking hard about Anthony Schwartz with my third pick, which was two picks before you ended up going with him. I was wondering if I was going to be able to sneak him to the next round, but the answer was obviously no. But I did go on.
Oh, sorry. I should have said earlier, I wanted to get Amir Smith-Marset where I took Hubbard, but Eric Kateri took him the pick before. And I guess some of the RotoWire office people were ragging on him because he's Iowa guy or something. It's like Amir, and he's on the Vikings, obviously. But yeah. Amir Smith-Marset is good. He's really good. And I really like him in Dynasty, especially. Not so much redraft, but Dynasty. I really wish I had gotten Amir Smith-Marset instead.
Yeah, I had to think harder. But when I ended up taking Gronk, I could have gone with Smith-Marset. But again, my receivers were good enough to where that, you know, I would have been eschewing a need for a luxury. So I just went with Gronk. But yeah, Smith-Marset, I think, is a really interesting name that I know you've been beating the drum for. Let's see, in the third round, before you went with Anthony Schwartz, I went with Elijah Mitchell. So I guess hearkening back a little bit to that San Francisco backfield, you know, I admittedly he's not going to at least profile cleanly for a role, but you know, it's not like Jeff Wilson profiled for a role, you know, this time a year ago. So, you know, Mitchell's toolsy guy, runs in the 4.3s, I believe, from his days at Louisiana, was crazy productive during his time there. So I just thought that was like a worthwhile, you know, swing for the fences, especially if like a year or two down the road. I know Sermon could be a roadblock potentially, but, you know, I don't envision like Mostert and Wilson being like there for years to come, to where Mitchell is, you know, kind of just a zero.
Right. I thought that was a really good pick, and I was kind of surprised Mitchell didn't go a little sooner. I think there's a case for having Mitchell and Sermon closer together in the rankings than generally acknowledged, just because the chance element is so great in that backfield when the replacement level is so high. It's like if all it takes is a guy to get a bit of a hot hand for a coach to kind of reshape his depth chart, then a guy like Mitchell can get a hot hand pretty easily. Like it's not even a Mitchell critic wouldn't even say that he can't do a Mostert kind of thing. Like the Mitchell critic would probably say like, oh, you can only run like one kind of play with him and he doesn't pass block and blah blah blah. It's like, doesn't matter for us. And if Mostert's if those Mostert carries exist and Mostert isn't there to take them, Mitchell might profile better for those than Sermon would. So there's a non-zero chance, like much greater than zero chance, that Mitchell has a better rookie year than Sermon, if only because if there's these Mostert-specific tasks, then it's Mitchell, not Sermon or anybody else, who is the obvious backup for those. So
right.
they could just scrap the Mostert role and say, like, oh, we're doing the Sermon show. And I guess that's probably what we should generally expect, but we can't know everything, and there's a chance that Mitchell's just really good.
Yeah, I think so too. So again, worthwhile, and he's got that speed to where, you know, it could only take a couple of plays for him to really change that coaching staff's opinion on how much they need to use him in that offense. Let's get on over. We'll table the dynasty talk. We'll pick it back up next week once the draft is hopefully finished. Let's move on over to this Atlanta offense and break it down a little bit. So I was taking a look-see at some things before the show today. This shouldn't be overly surprising, but again, with Atlanta hiring Arthur Smith from Tennessee, Atlanta ran the fourth most plays per game in 2020 at 67.7 plays per game. Tennessee ranked 22nd. So, an up-tempo Atlanta offense now being taken over by a guy who was lower tempo. Tennessee, this won't surprise anyone, third in the league in run play rate, a little bit over 50%. Atlanta was just 37% as far as their run plays versus the pass. Atlanta ran 11 personnel, so that's, three wide receivers, one running back, one tight end, 61% of the time last year, and 12 personnel just 15% of the time, while Tennessee ran 11 personnel just 38% of the time, which was the second fewest in the NFL, and 12 personnel at 35%, which tied with Philly for the most. So a lot of differences. I see the notepad coming out, so I'm excited. But what do we make of the fit here for Arthur Smith in Atlanta when Atlanta is so built in a way that's just so, that was so different from the way that Tennessee had things set up?
Yeah, so I initially had some trouble imagining what they would do with Kyle Pitts, and especially what they would do with Kyle Pitts and Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley there. But I feel kind of dumb for that now, because I think the answer is surprisingly obvious. It's just, it's not what we expected, even though the answer is obvious when you try to like retrace the steps that they've taken. But basically, Arthur Smith's just going to run kind of the opposite offense, pass attempt versus rush attempt volume-wise, that he did in Tennessee. But you can, anyone who's played Madden knows this, you can just run a variation on a theme. Like you can remember something as simple as the I formation, two wide receiver, all slants play, where it's the outside receivers both run slants and the tight end runs like a flat route or maybe a post slant kind of thing. And then that same play exists with the I formation three wide. And it's just, instead of the tight end being on the line, that's a receiver now, and he's in the slot and he's running the same route. So you can just run the same plays basically that they did in Tennessee, just with three wide receivers most of the time, with Pitts being one of those wide receivers instead of two tight ends each of those times. And it's like the splits are a little wider, and the pass attempts are more, greater volume to basically pick up the slack that exists from Derrick Henry not being there. And that slack can't be picked up by Mike Davis or anybody else that they might add between now and week one. However, that slack can definitely get picked up by Julio Jones, Calvin Ridley, and Kyle Pitts. So they're going to have to just run it. They're going to have to commit to a philosophy on offense where they're basically throwing to score. And yeah, they'll I'm sure, feature two tight end looks a decent amount, namely with Kyle Pitts out there. But when you have Kyle Pitts out there instead of Jonnu Smith or Michael Pruitt, that's going to have to be a different sort of alignment. Like, he's not going to be as tight with the line, and even in the so-called inline snaps, like, he's going to be in motion more. He's going to be lining up a little bit outside, getting him a little bit away from like the defensive tackles, the defensive ends, get him blocking with some momentum under him, rather than trying to like lift some heavy guy right out of his stance on the line. Little changes like that, that little as they might be, can, make the math work, and B, hold some pretty huge repercussions for the success of the offense as a whole. Because I think that you don't even really need to believe Matt Ryan's great or anything at this point to think that he's in for a big season. Like, I think we were both concerned about someone like Fields getting picked at that fourth overall spot and making Ryan a bit of a landmine at the ninth, 10th round range. But now I think he's actually right, one of the best values there. Like, I think he's going to throw for 5,000 yards this year. 17 games helps. I'm not saying it's a 5,000 yard 16 game season, but I think he's going to throw for 5,000 yards if he plays 17 games this year. And if Julio plays, let's say 14, and Ridley plays 16, and Pitts plays, 16 or 17. So I think what's basically going to happen here is you're going to see the same offense. It's just that some of these tight end snaps maybe get subtracted for slot receiver snaps, some of which, or even outside wide receiver snaps, some of which Pitts will qualify for. And then you get plenty of tight end snaps for Pitts too. It's just, again, they're going to be more incidentally in the slot and a little bit off the inline. Like the inline stuff is the guy Lee Smith that they signed, who's the blocking specialist, who was with the Raiders and the Bills for a long time. He's going to play the role that Jeff Swaim played last year, like the exclusively inline. I think you can expect him to play like 20-25 snaps a game in that role. Hayden Hurst will kind of be like the Jonnu Smith, Michael Pruitt type. I think he's going to play fewer snaps than he did last year, though. I think he's going for a demotion. I would expect, based on how Tennessee ran their offense last year, I think we can expect certain things to happen. Like the Titans basically ran 150 wide receiver snaps per game and 105 tight end snaps per game. Over the 16 games, 393 of those tight end snaps were in the slot. Only 25 were out wide. 1,200 or so were in line. So I think you're basically going to see something like that 1,200 number drop to 1,000 or something like that, because Pitts is going to take basically all of those and either put them a little bit into the slot or maybe even all the way out wide, or just something in between, kind of slot and in line, where he's the second tight end, but he's in line technically, but since he's the second tight end in the succession, he's pretty much more like an H-back kind of thing. He could get some snaps out of the backfield, but I don't really think so. Pitts could do just about anything that they want him to. Like, they can get him some screens, I guess, but I actually think Pitts is such a profoundly dangerous downfield receiver that they could not just have him wide at wide receiver, but have him in the slot, basically doing like Marcus Colston kind of things. Sending him downfield, down the seam from the slot is just so much stress on the defense down the middle of the field, especially if they're trying to already deal with Julio and Calvin Ridley. So I think all those guys could be really tough to stop. And if they're going this way, and I think they're basically compelled to, it makes me kind of optimistic about Arthur Smith, because it's the opposite of a Cliff Kingsbury thing. You know, like Cliff Kingsbury, if he got a team like the Titans, he would still try to run like five wide every play. Like, he doesn't have the insight to adjust. He doesn't fundamentally grasp anything well enough to know how things react to various courses of action. But I think Arthur Smith is showing some vision and showing the ability to apply principles on his own and kind of adapt and adjust. And that's all important. And I think that if they go with this passing attack, like, it would be hard to fail just because of how good the players are. And then I incidentally feel like we have reason to believe that Arthur Smith will also add some pretty smart schematic details, some smart play sequencing. So I'm pretty optimistic about it working, and it would reflect very well on Smith if he does show this ability to go from run heavy to pass heavy, basically using similar principles as he did before, but just with the ability to, you know, the vision to apply it in new ways that defenses don't anticipate. And if you're that kind of coach, you can kind of stay ahead of, you know, the adjustments as they occur. You can kind of keep the defense one step behind, even as they try to adjust to what you put on tape the prior week. And that can kind of keep you from hitting a wall in the season and keep you from going cold after a hot stretch. And with personnel like this, I think they could put some really big numbers up. And so the reason I looked at all this was specifically, I was trying to figure out, like, is Kyle Pitts worth this new ADP price and redraft? And I'm kind of reaching the conclusion that he is, even though it's also like outrageous and unprecedented.
So yeah, I mean, he's skyrocketing. Let me see here where he's
it's gotta be, yeah, like seventh round.
He's going let's see, his ADP looks like it's in the 70s according to Best Balls over the last so the highest he's gone is 30th, and he hasn't gone later than 111th dating back to the start dating back to the draft. So I guess dovetailing off of that, is this a stack that you might pursue? I mean, especially if you eschew Calvin Ridley in the second round, but you go after Julio in the third, Pitts maybe a round or two later, and then Matt Ryan in the ninth, that's a pretty good setup.
Yeah, I like it quite a bit. And so what I was projecting was basically something like 700 to 750 snaps over 17 games for Pitts. And what I'm imagining there is a fewer run reps than most tight ends who get to 700 snaps. And even among the passing, also in the passing reps, like the pass blocking rate should be basically zero. Like even when he, even if he gets credited with a pass blocking rep, it should just be like a chip shovel pass kind of setup where he's both blocking and running a route at the same time. So I don't think you need Kyle Pitts to be in like the top 15 for snaps logged among tight ends to still place in the top five at tight end, because it's as an extreme illustration that, you know, isn't sustainable over 700 snaps. Ricky Seals-Jones, his rookie year with the Cardinals, they did something where he would play like 10 snaps a game and get like four targets, because every time he was out there, it was basically just they're throwing to him. And you could kind of get something like that with Pitts, where he only plays 715 snaps, but still gets something like, I don't know. I don't want to put like an unfair or, you know, something that's ages poorly up as an example, but I feel like he could go something like 90 targets on 700 snaps. And if he goes 90 targets, like I don't know which is more reasonable to be concerned about with Pitts, the target volume or the per target efficiency. I feel like the target volume is almost the bigger concern, because I just cannot imagine Pitts failing in the way that it would take to make a poor efficiency. Like I can't see passes going toward him and him not catching them. It just doesn't seem possible to me. So I have to imagine if he doesn't get targets, it's because of something like Julio and Ridley are just so good, it's hard to get open as much as them, which is totally possible. But generally speaking, like I think we've seen enough double teams of Julio, especially in the red zone. Like in the red zone, I don't know what the hell a defense is supposed to do about Kyle Pitts. I don't know what you can do about it. So if you can choose to like not cover Julio and Ridley, but you also cannot, like you can't really do that. So it's something that I feel like it's like defenses are just going to kind of feel like they're just watching something happen helplessly. And in the red zone, especially, it's like if even if Pitts's yards per target is lagging or his catch rate is lagging, I feel like he should be the odds-on favorite to lead that team in receiving touchdowns, if only because Julio usually settles in at like six or seven over 16 games. And I don't think Ridley's been a touchdown guy. I guess maybe you'd make him the favorite, but I guess when accounting for
Pitts over Julio. Odds,
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say Ridley's been a touchdown guy for sure, and so he can keep doing that. But if it's like, you know, the odds are whatever, -150 on Ridley and it's +250 for Pitts, I definitely like Pitts' side better, because I don't know what you can do about him. I just don't think there's any way to stop him there.
Oh, man, so that, all right, I'm getting pretty excited about the outlook for this Atlanta offense. So let's hope that old Arthur Smith holds up his end of the bargain as you're projecting, and you know, we can really see some offensive fireworks back in Atlanta. Yep.
Yeah, real fast. Like people are comparing Pitts to past tight ends, past rookie tight ends, and trying to
can't do it.
You should instead be looking at Marquez Colston's rookie year, something like that.
Right. Because yeah, the whole narrative that, you know, John Carlson was like the leading tight end rookie receiver for like the last 20 years or something. It's like, if you're running into a situation where you're comparing the baseline to John Carlson, then like you're looking at this all wrong when it comes to Kyle Pitts.
Different position. That's totally different position.
100%. That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of the RotoWire NFL podcast, brought to you by our friends over at WinBet. We'll catch you next week.
Try RotoWire today, free for 10 days. Get our premium tools, rankings, analysis, and breaking news alerts. No credit card required. Go to rotowire.com/try.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.